Housing Bureau began really discussing this in earnest at the legislature last year. And all along, I and Gertie Needland have been supportive of lifting the ban to give cities another tool for affordable housing. So we think it's one of the important tools in the toolbox, I think, for all the reasons that Lisa and Maggie have stated. We agree that it's a tool that can be really useful for cities and has been deployed effectively in other jurisdictions. In particular, we believe that inclusionary housing can be valuable if the policy encourages production. I think you heard from Kat some of their concerns that we share around some of the current sort of calibration issues that we see as we start to run some of the numbers. Above all, I think we need a flexible program that will encourage production and density. And so Gertie Needland has been working with the Locus Development Group, which is a number, I think over 15 developers in the Portland area, who are all in support of the fundamental policy of inclusionary housing, believe that it's a policy that encourages healthy communities, and want to be a partner with the city on developing equitable housing throughout the city. So in that vein, we spent a lot of time as a group sort of analyzing the various different policy, program and policy pieces of advice that have come out of Portland Housing Bureau and some of the various, you know, there's been a lot of different metrics that we've examined between the different zones and the different various offsets that have been suggested. And we've shared a lot of that information with PHB and with the Planning and Sustainability Commission. And I think overall, there's a lot about the recommendation from PHB that that has legs, that can work, that we feel will not stall production or create, you know, a huge flight by developers. But there are also some fundamental concerns, I think, that we still have about some of the recommendations, in particular around the mixed-use zone. And we've sort of heard a couple of times today that the mixed-use zones are one of the areas where I think we've grappled the most with how to find sort of that effective calibration. And we're still a little worried and haven't spent a lot of time yet with sort of the revised policy that came out today to really understand it, but are still concerned that the calibration there is not really where it needs to be. And I think in particular I worry about, you know, density goals and production and then things like, you know, meeting sustainability goals at the city and quality construction in some of these zones. And wondering whether we're going to really see impact to those other goals that the city has around, you know, really high sustainability, you know, high quality materials and construction means and methods, and whether, you know, we're going to start to compromise some of those goals as well if we are not sort of balancing our offsets effectively for some of those policies. I want to address a little bit Amanda's, Commissioner Fritz's question about the developer profit, because I think I'm not sure where the 25% comes from. I think that it's probably a combination of really what our economic investors are looking for from a project, as well as what a developer at the end of the day, you know, gains from a project. And we sort of make our money from projects in a couple of ways. One is through a kind of overhead fee that we take, which tends to be about 3 to 5% of the hard and soft cost of a project, depending on the project size and sort of complexity. And that really pays our fees and costs as a developer of operating. And that's sort of a set fee that we build into our pro forma. And then above and beyond that, really, our profit is largely calibrated on a preferred return, which is really and we bring in an economic investor, an investor, you know, institutional investor or a local investor to, you know, really bring the, so we, you know, put construction debt or typical debt on the property, maybe 50 to 60% of the cost of a project is financed with debt, and the other 40 to 50% is equity. And that equity comes from whether institutional investors or local investors. And they have a number of thresholds that they're looking for economically to make in a project. And so there's a number of different ways that they look at that. Some of it is cash-on-cash returns, which is basically what's the cash flow as a percentage of the cost to build. That's sort of an initial metric, and then it's a really a rate of return over a period of years of how long they intend to own, you know, be in an ownership position in the project. And the developer is often a participant in that equity stack, typically not a huge participant, maybe, you know, 0 to 10%. And typically our return is sort of calibrated with that investor's return and often is structured as a preferred return. So we're, once the investor is getting a hurdle rate, you know, a certain level of return that they're expecting in the project, the developer serves to profit. So really we're sort of taking some risk around, you know, the project performing. And so that's really how we calibrate our, you know, investment in the project. But a lot of what we're doing when we run a pro forma is really looking at our investors' requirements and what they're going to need from an economic perspective to invest in a project. And so I think a lot of, you know, where we come from as we're looking at these numbers is really, are we achieving a project that's going to attract capital? And so, you know, when we think about a pro forma where we're, you know, reducing incomes, you know, because we're reducing rents on a certain percentage of units, how do we, you know, either recapture that back up to the level it needs to be at or close to that level? And I think that's what we're hearing about, is the full, you know, kind of a question of, are we trying to achieve full abatement, full, you know, return on that loss of income, or are we getting partly there, right? And I think our group has said, you know, we're willing to take some level of responsibility toward that, maybe 5 to 10%. Planning and sustainability would like to get us all the way there, which is great, but I think, you know, we've said we can accept some limited responsibility for this, but at some point our investor is going to choose to invest in a project elsewhere or, you know, not invest in Portland.
There's a difference between the investor who's building and then the owner of the building long term. Because Gooding Eaglin doesn't own things long term, right?
It varies project by project. We frequently will own a project for a number of years, and then there'll be a sale event at maybe 2 to 10 years where Gooding Eaglin and our investor are no longer have an ownership stake in the project.
And why? What's to stop an owner just charging a bit more for the market rate or even luxury, which I understand most of the apartments that have been built recently have been luxury level? Why wouldn't the owner ongoing charge everybody else more in order to cover the low fee, and then that's continuing to drive our average rental rate up?
I think that's one of the concerns in the market, certainly, is that we will have an unforeseen sort of impact on affordability. So we may obtain those 10 to 20% affordable units, but conversely, on the other side of the market, we're only building very luxury apartments. So we're missing that middle. And at some point, the market also has a cap on what people can pay, even in the luxury market. I mean, we're starting to see that happen now in our units where we've achieved sort of full, you know, I think that our rents are as high as they can go.
I think that this goes to the point that David Rosen made earlier, which is to imagine the scenario that you're talking about, which I understand that it makes intuitive sense, is to imagine that right now people are not already charging what the market will bear in terms of rents. That somehow through magnanimity, people are not charging market rents in their market units, and that there's like way more increase that could be pushed because of these affordable units.
I don't think we have seen that. I mean, we've just seen rents going up, you know, 100%, 300% across the board. And I'm starting to get worried that we're guaranteeing the developer 25%. We're guaranteeing that the ongoing ownership continues to be profitable. And it seems to be all by city subsidy and also things like parking, which neighbors are concerned about. And eventually we're going to have to do something about that.
I would note that, and I'm not the expert, every year someone from Gooding Eaglin comes and gives us a view, and whether it's Jill Sherman when we did the big look, and you, and I almost think, Dan, we should have an annual work session to invite a certified smart person from Gooding Eaglin to come in and walk through a pro forma on development, because it's very complicated, but you you and Jill have the gift of explaining it in terms that even I can understand. But what I think, to your point, we're seeing a bifurcated market. The growth in rents is at the lower and moderate incomes levels, and that's impacting real people with a vengeance. We're seeing a softening at the top, and I only know that because I've been talking to a bunch of developers, and you're seeing now things like incentives. You're seeing an extra month rent. You're seeing other adjustments because there is a sense, and with the 14, 15,000 in the pipeline, we may be getting to the point where we're overbuilding for that market, and we're building. Remember, the stuff that's been built over the last 4 years largely is in the luxury end. The affordable piece has been very small. If the rents on what we loosely call affordable are coming up, but at the luxury end where the market has been building, we're seeing a softening. And where you land here in terms of what's the right incentive to make sure we don't scare away investment and development is a hard question, because we can't predict what the market's going to be tomorrow. We don't know how many people are crying wolf. We have the experience of other communities where we don't have the same generous incentives and sideboards, and it still works. But if we don't get it right, I mean, from my point of view, if we don't get it right, then it's a self-defeating exercise. So that's where I land ultimately.
So, I'm sorry, Kat, that members of the Planning Commission didn't join us for more of the panel and experts meetings, because we really went through a very thorough conversation. I think a number of very revelatory things happened in those conversations, one of which was members of development industry saying things like, we know the market is softening, the bottom will fall out, we will blame inclusionary zoning, regardless of whether that's the reason why. So I think we have to be really careful in understanding this is an industry, it goes through business cycles, there are things that are happening, there are things that are changing. We go through a process, we create a policy, and we can do that based on our best understanding of the economic analysis and economic research that's happened here and in other places, and sort of move forward. It will be a long ramp-up period because of the development pipeline that exists right now. There is time for people to recalibrate their businesses or for other firms to enter the market who can work under these particular regulatory conditions.
See, my assumption is that, yes, people are charging whatever the market will bear right now. So I'm not concerned that people are going to raise rents more than they otherwise would, personally, deliberately, because they have to build affordable units. It seems to me that the real concern is if we adopt policies that result in fewer units overall being built and fewer than the demand warrants, then you just see supply and demand resulting in the price of the limited number of units we're building being built. So it seems to me that's the question.
And I would just say that was exactly the concern of the PSC. You expressed it very eloquently. And that might be true, but all I'm trying to say is that the PSC didn't feel they had the information to be able to advise otherwise.
Sorry. No, it's good. Everyone can't talk at one time. I see her. That result is not borne out by the best economic research. And in the absence of a time machine, right, we don't have a time machine, so we can't say exactly what happens in the future. In the absence of that, the best economic research says that there is not an overall impact on housing supply from inclusionary policies. And in a market that is hot and a population that is growing, it's a little hard to imagine a complete shutdown of a development pipeline that exists, right, with some 15,000 units already ready to go.
You said that the research doesn't bear it out. I mean, I would assume there'd be some parameters on that. I mean, if we decided to mandate that 90% of units be affordable to below 60% MFI, then I would assume that would have inhibit supply somewhat.
That would be far outside the bounds of the varieties of inclusionary policies that exist in the world. So that would be an probably untested proposition, because we test what exists in the world. I understand that the Planning Commission heard some testimony around the research analysis, and I would describe that testimony as being less informed than it could have been, having read carefully the body of research here on these questions. The body of research does not show significant impacts on supply of housing from inclusionary policy.
So in light of that, Dr. Bates, do you think that this doesn't go far enough? Do you think that you could reasonably jack it up to 30% or something like that with the same level of incentives?
I think that, as described by David Rosen and Associates, that this is a level of incentive and a level of offset that is greater than is typical for inclusionary housing.
So is that a way of saying, yes, you think with these kind of incentives we could have a higher inclusion rate?
I think there's a limit placed by the state legislature. I think there's been an analysis that, you know, every step of this analysis, the DRA and Eco Northwest analysis, is based on prototypes from the numbers provided by development industry persons, the somewhat less transparent pro forma provided by the Locust Group is provided by people from the development industry, and that this proposal fits within the parameters of both of those things with a reasonable level of offset for the provision of inclusionary units.
Which is really helpful. Did you look at, in the research, where is the tipping point? Excuse me. So if it's cost neutral now to the developer, how much more could we ask for that would be cost neutral too?
I don't have a specific answer to that, but I can try to find out before the 8th.
I think one important piece to remember here is that again, we're developers attracting capital to a market, and at some point, capital is going to go elsewhere. There's plenty of other markets in which, you know, the large institutional investors who are coming to Portland and investing in our market right now, there are plenty of other options for them nationwide where they can put their money. And at some point, the downward pressures of you know, the impact of an inclusionary policy without adequate offsets will move money elsewhere. And that is a concern, I think, that we can't forget.
Dan, can I do a time check and a process check?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think we're at the point where we want to thank this panel. I'd like to call staff back up.
Okay, good. That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. Thank you all. Thanks for your service on the panel of experts and the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Thank you. So I'd like to bring staff back up just to answer any further questions, get any further directions. I mean, my goal here was if there are changes to the recommended policy, I'd like to be able to presented in the form of a substitute on the 8th. So it's important to get your feedback now or in the ensuing week, because we already filed today, the December 8th, the package that was presented to you today.
Yeah, and I need to read through everything we've been given and think about it. I don't have it today.
Sure, sure.
I've got a bunch of questions, and I just want to clarify some things. So. And you've already addressed a couple of them, but let's start with your intent in terms of bringing forward changes to Title 33 and Title 30. And could you restate what your goal is for December 8th?
So there are changes that have been filed for Title 3 and Title 30 through Mayor Hales and Commissioner Saltzman that will come to you simultaneously on December 8th.
Okay. So, just so I understand this, Title 33 is really where we address the land use issues. Title 30 is where we talk about implementation and some of the goals. If there's a fight here at some point, it'll be a legal challenge. It'll be under Title 33. Am I right on that?
Yes, but I might ask Lauren to clarify.
Definitely, necessarily, right? Because we get getting challenged on the SDCs and things.
Well, but that's the route you go to Luba on if you had a dispute, I think. But so you're going to bring it was an issue raised by the commission. It's something that was in the memo we got. So you're going to bring both together to us next Thursday. Is that correct?
Yes, we filed this morning after our testimony and everything is being provided to the clerk of the council. I would underscore that changes to Title 30, the housing statute, are ministerial, and we can more easily amend the calibration, which is intentionally structured that way, so that we're not subject to a LUBA appeal each and every time we change the offsets.
And Commissioner, if I might just piggy on what you just said, could I ask that what we just voted on last week in terms of the required parking going away, which I now understand means it goes away for everybody because it's not just the units that are affordable, it's the entire project. I'd like to vote on that again because I can't support that. I thought at the time that we were going to have much more time to look through it and to hear more people's testimony on it. I think since last week I've got probably 20, 30 comments on email. And so I would have hoped we would have had a more, well, I hope we will still have a robust discussion about it because that's one of the questions that were being asked, right? Is that level of subsidy the right level?
I don't know what the protocol on that. I think it was a 4-1 vote, but I would take that up with the mayor. But let's go back to some of the things that we've discussed today. So one of the issues that Steve has raised and someone who's testified raised is about the cost. And so we do have a memo from Andrew Scott. And I guess, Dan, I'd like to have a deeper dive on that. And not now.
Yeah, we'll provide a detailed response to the budget office.
Yeah. And just by way of history, when 6 years ago or so, when we did the big look with the county around our tax abatement policies, we considered it as part of that package. You know, the county put a hard cap on $1 million. Subsequently, when we had the housing emergency and circumstances changed, Dan, you negotiated with Deborah a lifting of that cap to $3 million, which is a significant change from what used to be a hard cap of $1 million. We're now talking about a further raising of that cap, and that, of course, would require the county commission's approval plus the assessor. Plus, there are trade-offs. They, depending on what we're funding, these are dollars that otherwise would go to fund other basic services. So, and David, you mentioned that certainty is very important. So if we're not sure about the mix of incentives and packages, we have to be as clear as we can, and then we're going to have a backup plan to substitute something in. I mean, the thing about a tax abatement is it's foregone revenue, and we like them for a lot of reasons, but it a substitute for that is actually a direct subsidy rather than a foregone revenue. So there are different ways of getting there, but I want to get my arms around the cost. It's not just to understand the cost. That's just good government. We want to know going in what the cost is, and I think I have a pretty good track record of being willing to, you know, swing for the fences on that. It's at some point also looking at what are we buying. The crushing need in our community is 0 to 60, and I just want to make sure that the subsidies are going to where the need is, because those are dollars that could come from other pocket. And we keep being told that it's the full-time minimum wage worker, it's the older adult on fixed income, it's the working class family, it's the formerly homeless family. Those are the people that need our help. And so I want to make sure that our subsidies and our dollars are targeted to where the greatest need is.
Commissioner, this will be one of my last chances to respond to that, which I've heard you say many times. I actually perceive that there's a crushing need in our community for more housing anywhere from like 0 to 200% of MFI, because the entire community, except the very wealthy, are struggling with high housing prices.
And the only thing I'll say, because I'm not, I've learned not to get into a debate with Steve on certain things, but I will say that the one thing we've learned in the last decade is that the cost of not addressing the most acute need swamps our systems in ways that having my daughter maybe double or triple up in an affordable apartment doesn't. I just want to once again remind that the reason we're looking increasingly upstream to prevent, and we're looking at ways, and we're looking at daylighting what the true costs are, the person who is struggling on the street or about to go on the street with a family, the cost of not providing that housing swamps the societal cost of not providing my daughter with her own studio. I mean, just in relative terms. And that doesn't take away from each individual's needs. But just from a government cost point of view, if we don't get a handle on where the greatest need is, we're going to be swamped with the cost of managing a failed system one way or another. And that's why I keep coming back to prioritizing that. But anyway, let me just we're not going to solve that issue today. I guess a little bit more on, we had a fascinating debate, one of the best I've ever witnessed here about what is the right mix on incentives, how do we make sure we get it right, and very thoughtful people disagreed. So I just, whatever additional thoughts you have on that, I think you would benefit from, why it is that you're confident that you've hit the sweet spot and that it isn't going to suppress, and to the extent you also believe that these incentives are sweeter than some other jurisdictions and the sky didn't fall in those jurisdictions, I think that would be useful to be pointed in that direction, because that may be, history may be our best guide. I haven't had a chance, Dan, to really fully digest your compromise, but I appreciate that it is responsive to some concerns people raised about a particular part of your proposal. And that's in the package you filed?
Yes.
Okay, so we can.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
We can debate that. And and I guess the other thing, I just want to make sure I understand the impact, assuming we don't change our decision that we made last week on the parking minimums, I just want to understand, and you had a chart, you had a slide in here that addressed it in part, how does that take some pressure off the other tools that you're putting in the kit? Because my hope at the time was that we could take some pressure off some other tools so that that became a bigger component of the incentive package. And I think your chart indicates that it actually has significant value in terms of to the developer, but I'd like to just understand better how that's going to work. And I thank you, Dan, and your team for an excellent presentation today.
Thank you very much. Anything anybody wishes to add? I mean, we will... Yeah, it's great work, and we appreciate it. I guess I'll just add that, you know, I think as maybe Kurt might have said in his opening remarks, this is an art, not a science. And the best way we're going to figure out if we got it calibrated right is to go ahead and do it. And I think there's been a lot of time, a lot of brain power invested in trying to get this right by everybody who's got an interest in this. And I think now falls on us to, you know, take the plunge. And I feel we've got a reasonably crafted policy here, and, you know, we can micromanage it forever and in the hopes of trying to get a perfect policy, but we're not going to get a perfect policy until we have a policy on the ground and we have a chance to calibrate it or recalibrate it as market conditions reveal themselves. So I'll just add that as my closing 2 cents.
Thanks to our
Thank you, everybody.